I'm Alan Watts, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 25th of October, 2020. And as always, I hope you're all getting by as best as you can during these incredible Looney Tunes times, because that's what we're in, isn't it? It's all crazy. And it's planned that way. There's never been such a massive psyops operation coordinated worldwide at the same time, which tells you you obviously have a global coordination factor involved in it, a kind of government, you might say, when everybody at the top and every country is on board with the exact same agenda, which is lauded by the World Economic Forum, so they're a big part of it. These are the same guys who attend every year the progress towards globalization and the global system they're always on about. In fact, they're rather ticked right now that populism is rising. You'll see that in all the World Economic Forum, the Club of Rome, all the big affiliated groups that really are one big system at the very top of the world, the Bank for International Settlements, United Nations, the World Bank, IMF, etc. They're all part of this global structure that's to bring in a global society. Something like you can't vote for any of it, of course, because they don't believe in democracy, except to fool you once in a while to get to go and vote. Because really, if you vote, you're voting in your masters, and you're giving authority over you to these people. You give it away, you see. Kind of crazy, isn't it, when you think about it? And I gave talks back in the 90s on that very thing. It's a legality. And they don't have to tell you any real truth. There's no law that says, by the way, that politicians should not lie to you. I remember going through these talks years ago when I was debated at very high places. And they actually came out in Canada and said at one point from the High Court, or Supreme Court in Canada, that people who run for politics, even local or state or provincial or national, they said there's no law where they have to actually tell you the truth and stick to it. It's not like they're giving you a pact. You just have to agree to allow them to rule over you when you vote them in. And that's quite simple, isn't it? Once selected, a politician or a group of them or the whole government can do as they want, regardless of what they promise the public. It's never been any different, really. And it's always a test of your gullibility. That's what I've always thought about, gullibility and naivety. That's why they like you to be naive and to believe what you're told all the time. I've mentioned before, too, many times over many, many years, that voting every 5 years or so is a good way to delay revolutions or rebellions. Generally, rebellion is a proper name, because a rebellion is when you're not happy about changes that are happening, you see. Either taxes going up or something like that, or getting told to stay in your homes nationwide. Things like that. Because they're a bit, so you just vote new people in all the time. Because you're sick of the people who've been in the last lot of rules and regulations and globalized laws, etc., for their trading partners, the big top trading partners on the planet. That's what globalization is about. Who can trade and who can't? And under public-private partnerships, of course, we fund all big projects. All the big projects. There's nothing new in what I'm telling you. It's just that they haven't been told for a long time what it's all about. And also, you'd have to read the old books about it. The old globalists in the 19th century, the H.G. Wells's types, who wrote lots of good fiction, science fiction, with a lot of eugenics involved in it too, you'll notice. But he wrote fiction about a utopia to come, and he also wrote it as a kind of almost like a documentary type style of what was to come, like a modern utopia. And he talked about how would they get rid of the excess population, the unnecessary population in this wonderful socialist system. Socialism, remember, was to be a world ruled by experts. And human value is given by religion, or developed through the millennia by religion and humans and themselves, obviously. would be disregarded altogether and discarded eventually until you're living totally under authority by professionals and experts. And that's what communism was supposed to eventually be based on. And two, communism, remember, was never totally achieved in the Soviet system because it was meant eventually to train the public and train through generations, almost like a genetic indoctrination. and the Lysenko type style, only to do with people instead of plants, that they would train people, and they become genetic memory, so you'd be better and better citizens of each generation as time went on, until you have the perfect system where all the old values of me first or me surviving would all be put or basically destroyed, because you had to serve the greater good, you see, and you do it willingly eventually in a perfect Soviet system. And eventually you wouldn't even need money. You'd be allocated, like credits, same thing that Bertrand Russell talked about for the British socialist system. And don't get confused by socialism. There's different meanings to it depending on who you happen, or what organizations you happen to belong to. And the top capitalists were always for socialism-communism, because it's better to have an efficient system, a technocratically run system. If you've got a public that will obey you, the obstacle has always been individual rights and individualism. And so they have to get rid of that. So again, H.G. Wells talked about it in the modern utopia, about getting rid of the excess population. You don't need them anymore. These silly, you know, feelings of humankind and bonded together as a human. Nonsense. No, get rid of the ones that are inferior and you don't need anymore, he said. And he said, we used to think that we'd have to kill them. But he said, we decided to sterilize them instead, and they'd gradually just die out because they couldn't reproduce. This is in modern utopia, Wells. Wonderful characters they give you to follow, eh? And you like a lot of their stories. You say, that's a fascinating time machine story there, and that's wonderful, and I'm enthralled. And but again, he was given the star-making machinery, and it couldn't fail, basically. It wasn't just one person writing material. He had professors handing him lots of stuff for his books and people to help him write his stuff, you see. And he made him into a star, because you follow the stars. And if H.G. Wells said that was the way to go, then so should you. You're clever. He was clever, and you're not so clever. You're not rich and famous like him, see? And that's the proof of it right there. That's how easy it is. And that's how they create the stars in the big machine. Like actresses and actors and that kind of thing. They actually make stars out of scientists now, too. Big publicity, you know. When you see billions and billions of stars, things like that. And then you start, when they get off the subject of science, you start following, oh, I guess maybe he's right there, too, you know. What I'm saying here is everything that's happening today is simply the culmination of centuries of indoctrination and techniques being used on the public, which they're completely unaware of. And you'll never really catch on to. You think things are just happening now. You don't realize that the incredible, tremendous work that's gone in to getting to the stage of the game. Never mind through technologies. They couldn't do it without the internet and computers. Couldn't do any of it without that, because they must know everything about every single individual on the planet. And then they've got to get you all into a system where you can't even feed yourself without digital currency. And then they start doing what Bertrand Russell suggested they do in the 1940s and 50s. He said eventually, well, the state will dish out credits. No, credits, just money, you know, a token, if you like. And put to your bank account, and you couldn't save it up in the new system that's to come. If you didn't use it all in the same month, it will start off at the same amount again. Like if it's 500 C for credits, it will be 500 again the next month, and they'll pay. You have to pay your cost of living out of that, and so on. And if you're bad, he said it too. It's a social credit system. Yeah. Which they planned way back in the 40s and 50s that would come down the road. People think this is happening now, and you'd have to behave and do what you're told, or else you'd be cut off, just like they can cut you off the internet now and stop your work if they want to. And they're openly talking about it, and they're doing it across the board in some ways. There's nothing new under the sun. It's just that now is the time to do it all, because they have the perfect system to make you comply. That made it pretty well impossible for so many people to get through without, the internet and digital currency, and everything's done on the computer now, or cell phone. And it was planned that way, and you buy your chains. Oh, I want that flashing light there. It's pretty colours, and it's got more pixels than the last one, Lucifer, eh? The light. You're just dazzled by it. And the folk, honestly, you can't help them, but they're too far gone, and it's not their fault. You see, they're brought up like that and trained to accept it all as quite natural, never realising that very important folk, as far as history goes, talked about this coming system long ago, long before you heard of a computer, in fact, and how they make it all happen. But again, back to the Soviet system, as the Soviet system was never really achieved, because eventually, through generations of raising the perfect children, the perfect children, the perfect children, and basically somehow breeding out of the idea of selfishness, then you'd all be there to serve the state. Again, cogs in the wheel, you see. And that's what you'd be. That'd be the function of you. And you'd accept it quite happily. And there'd be big supermarket stores, you said, eventually. This has gone way back many, many years before the giant supermarkets you have today in supermarket stores. And they said eventually you'd walk in, for be it food or hardware, and you would just take what you needed. And that was it. No extras, no maybe two and just in case. You'd all take just wait because you're a perfect citizen. And that's what they want. They want basically drones, people as drones, basically. That's what they want me to be. And but they never achieved it, of course, still to come. And it's astonishing to me in some ways, because you can see the psychopathy behind it. There's no doubt about that at all. And psychopaths are way more numerous than you think. And you also have a whole layer of them below that work as civil servants, that accept the diktats of the masters, you see. And they'll also push whatever order they're given to the limit. That's why you end up with massacres, mass slaughters, and then perhaps even genocides, eh? Genocides, generally, they don't say, come into this camp, we're going to kill you. They might say, come in this camp, we'll be safe, you know. They've already got these camps going up across the world under the guise of COVID and even future releases and of diseases and things, you see. So you got to step way back, stand back a bit here. This is governments talking, eh? And do you really believe them? They've closed the economies of the whole planet down together in unison, regardless of the facts from people working in the hospital, like thousands of them across the planet working in the hospitals, coming together and saying, what you're telling the public isn't matching up. And people are getting banned on the internet just for repeating it. This is total war. Total war. Of an authoritarian nature that the world has never seen. Never seen the lens of the where you'd literally shut up everybody. You know, in the KGB or the NKVD, in the old Cheka groups, after the Bolshevik Revolution, they just brought folk in and slaughtered them. And then they went and they made it known what was happening. Folk were disappearing all the time. And they made it known what was happening to terrify the rest of the folk to comply, you see. And you're seeing it happening now without grabbing folk physically. And at the moment, this will happen in the next few weeks, by the way. Because under the staged lockdowns, it also is a staging, color-coded idea of going after people who are speaking out against the top authorities. They're all in lockstep, as they say, together to push all of this. This isn't just a COVID thing. It's rather obvious. You don't crash economies. You don't put people totally at risk if they can't even get into hospitals for regular. They've got the same messages out now that don't even go into hospitals if you don't have to, even if you have something really severe. Well, we've already had lots of folk dying with heart attacks and so on at home. through the whole farce, you know, February, March and April. Namely, and again, the old folks' homes, because folk were terrified. Look what they were going to do. Can you imagine being listening to the news? They were listening to the same news, the national news, getting the same horror stories in the old folks' homes. And all they kept repeating is, old folk are going to die, old folk are going to die. And then they tell it, we're going to ram these tubes down your trachea, huh? And make you breathe by a machine. But that's dangerous too. That might kill you. Rather than give you basic treatments, what they've given people every winter through spring, when you get the cold flu seasons coming on, when all the bronchial problems really start up big time every year. That's why they're counting so badly on what happens every late fall, and the weather changes, gets damp and then cold and so on. And you're guaranteed to get folk go to the doctors initially. Now they might just cut them off into the hospitals. And don't forget COVID. It also includes the common cold. It's a coronavirus. And the tests, the PCR tests detect these things as well. They detect fragments of coronaviruses. Fragments, not viruses, but fragments of what could have been. Coronaviruses. It's so iffy. It's perfect, really. That's why they can't lose by having fights about data, you know, and throwing out massive figures by computers, like Neil Ferguson was doing. The same man, by the way, they helped destroy the entire meat supply of Britain at one point with a mad cow disease and his computer systems. All slaughtered, eh? This man is a one-man wrecking machine. So why do you think he gets the job of giving you advice? It's because he's a psychopath, folks. He's no... The average person, if they know what they're doing, is, would you please go along with this and really convince the public to be terrified? And I've got to give up all rights and so on. And lots of folk will die because of it, of depression, or they can't get into hospital, they're afraid to go to hospital, or they won't be admitted anyway to hospital, etc. So want you to do it. You might have qualms if you're a normal human being, but a psychopath doesn't. They don't have anxiety. It's something which is lacking in them, is anxiety. If anything happens to a psychopath in their life that threatens their ability to manipulate freely throughout society, locally and on a larger scale with their politicians, then, or even on top of the military, you find them in the military too, different categories of them. Actors and actresses are the hysterical, attention-seeking psychopath. That's a category they fall into as well. So, yeah, you may have a breakdown if you were forced to do it. And even if you're told initially it's for the greater good, you know, the noble lie. It's for the greater good. And history will justify it, you know. And when history doesn't justify it, you'd start to have a breakdown, you see. Because you were responsible for maybe millions of folk dying. Because they couldn't get to hospital, or they couldn't get diagnosed, and they couldn't get their cancer treatments. And early cancer treatments, if they can get a primary tumour, they can get it out quick and get a darn good chance of survival. If you can't get in, and every day counts then, you see, when it's diagnosed. And what's happening is a horror show. There's been lots of staffs in hospitals across the world come out, nurses and doctors, about this. It makes no difference to the agenda, though, eh? And that's your telling point here. It isn't just like some automaton that just takes over because they can't think straight at the top. This is an agenda which knows darn well what's going on. And it ties in completely with the Great Reset, you know, the global Great Reset of the World Economic Forum that was to follow the 2007 and 8 crash that they talked about, this big reset. And the reset is not just the resetting of the value of your currency. It's your whole way of living. It's the way of living they've been telling you about and trying to get to accept since Maurice Strong fronted for the Rockefeller Foundation for 1992. That was the big one, the big biodiversity treaty came out of it, of course. And it was to literally dismantle all industry within the Western nations. That was part of it, a big part of it. And they said that we won't be happy till we've literally dismantled even all the energy units to bring down the standard of living in the West, which also would take down a lot of the life capacity for people, because you need energy to live on and buy. Nature is a nasty enemy. You get away from the flower power idea of flowers in your hair here and realize that nature is something we've struggled with for, who knows, thousands and thousands of years, at least, to survive within, because it's very cruel and it doesn't care. There's no consciousness that says, I care about you, as I'm nature, I care about you. It doesn't exist. Sometimes you feel close to it, closer than others, that magical moment in a nice sunny day, that kind of thing. But the rest of the time, if it goes into sudden freezes and you don't have any heat, you die rather nastily. Huh? Or if you fall in that beautiful lake, and you've seen the pictures and the photographs, if you fall in that lake there, it doesn't care if you drown or not. And it's just like the beautiful sea. I mean, it's lovely. It's great to travel on ships. I much prefer ships because you're linked to the past as well. You're traveling the same sea routes that people did thousands of years ago, and at least hundreds, but thousands too, because we're far older than Italy, especially when it comes to sea travel. And definitely you're traveling the same sea routes as Vikings and other groups down through history traveled, and traders from, it's like America BC, yeah? Fantastic book to read, and other books too by Barry Fell, interesting books indeed. Interesting again, because we live in such a this is the way it is system, where some kind of strange authority that exists, and this is getting back to again into the old ideas of these secretive governing groups, which definitely exist. There's no doubt in it at all. Like Carl Quigley talked to it. You might even get that audio. Yeah, I don't know if it's still out there. Professor Carl Quigley, who literally groomed people to be, you know, presidents and to run the State Departments and have massive incomes and have tremendous power across the world, including the military too. Because the military-industrial complex, he was all for it and taking over the world, etc. And he was an elitist himself, Carl Quigley. He liked to boast about it. And psychopaths do like to boast about their little parts in it too, sometimes. And that's where he came out with Tragedy and Hope. That immediately got hammered by the publisher, and realized he'd letting a lot too much out of the bag, you know. And he said, I agree with it. He said, I'm not against what these groups are doing, especially the main group. And he said, I object occasionally about some of their methods, but that was his only objection to the system. But the audio, it was to one of his students at university that he was grooming, and he met in the cafeteria, and it was being recorded, tape recorded, and he pulls out a dollar bill of all things, you know, the conspiracy theory idea. But here's Professor Carl Quigley, a guy who was the historian for a while, for the archives of an alternate history of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Lord Alfred Milner Group, same group, and also CFR, and the American branch at that time. He got into their archives and it explained what really caused wars. And they were behind it. And he thought it was wonderful, and they should come out. And he said the world was ready to accept this kind of knowledge. And to learn the part that this organization had to play in it. Well, the people didn't want the public to know that these characters had been behind different wars and taking over the world's resources and had future wars to come, and how they'd backed certain totalitarian nations and so on. And they studied these nations, eh? So he wanted to boast about it. So they did. They kind of grabbed these books. They bought the plates too, the actual plates. But luckily, others managed to get some of the first editions and tore them apart and put them together again. And they are accurate, because I've seen both copies, the original ones and the and the ones which have no copyright anymore, but they are the original article, duplicates, nothing's missing in them. So he appeals to the dollar bill to this, and he says, but listen, he says, don't tell anybody, he says, it's bad for your career if anybody finds out. Couldn't mean the conspiracy idea, right? And they said, but look on that dollar bill, there's an all-seeing eye and a pyramid. What do you know? He says, that symbol is thousands of years old, he says. And he starts talking about it a little bit. And he's trying to get through to this person, this youngster he's grooming, to be a leader, you see. That's what they do, they pick future leaders. And he's telling them that there's a bigger power running the whole system than just you electing whoever's put in front of you to vote for. He's grooming the guy. But anyway, that audio got out there, and you might be able to listen to it if you get a hold of it. And that's how the world really is run, though. This is the professor that member that Bill Clinton gave accolades to, and he said that was his mentor, was Professor Carol Quigley, that got him into politics and got him the Rhodes Scholarship. So he could go over to London and skip off to Russia. That's what happened. That's what he did, too. But anyway, that's the world we're living in. It's vastly different from the worlds we're trained to believe in. In fact, they couldn't, as I say, get the agenda through without making us incredibly naive. And it's true, once you're in school, age of five or whatever it is, you're immediately indoctrinated into what they tell you is reality. And that's what I've always said. I've said this before, this essential primary school indoctrination is essential. Because as Jack Lowell said, that without that initial indoctrination, subsequent indoctrination will not take. You'll see through it, even if you're only 7 or 8 or maybe 10 or 12, you'll see through it. But if you get that early indoctrination, you're being trained just to listen to obey and accept. You see, there's no debate then. And that's how the world really is. And sure enough, every 30, 40 years, some parts of vaults are opened, because it's part of revelation of the method. That's what it's called, getting back to that all-seeing eye in the pyramid. and by the way, I've got some really old encyclopedias here, very old, where they have the people who contended amongst each other in the United in Americas during the Revolutionary War and even before it, of what kind of symbols they would put forth, with all their names there and the different ones that they put forward to be accepted for the Great Seal, etc. And the currencies they were using. You know, it's quite fascinating to realize they actually had currencies in the Americas and during the Revolutionary War, and afterwards, by the way, including Masonic currencies, where they have the all-seeing eye on the actual coins themselves. It's quite fascinating to see it. So yes, that's a whole sideline to itself. Anyway, but to run a segue into that, I'll continue what I'm trying to prattle on about here, which is your reality, vastly different than what you've been taught to believe in. And people are pretty decent. Decent people. It doesn't matter about being ultra likable, but the decent people have decency in them. And that's what elites and psychopaths count on, is that you'll have this decency factor. And if you take the history of, say, parts of Britain, even from the 1800s onwards, it was rather hellish for most folk, you know. It's bad enough when you live in a country where you grow to a tall, pretty tall in Scotland right now, until you hit about 18 and your long bones ossify, they stop growing. And then with all that rain, you start shrinking again, eh? So that's why you never throw your clothing away for when you're young, because eventually you'll be able to wear it again, because you're shrunk into it. So that's the whole thing. It's a pretty miserable country when it's pouring rain all the time. In Britain, it was so managed in a feudal system for such a long time, it was kind of ingrained in the people, you know? And it wasn't until they gave basic education in the 19th century to the general population, the working population, just so they could follow instructions and written instructions for working machinery and factories and keep records and notes for the bosses. Otherwise, they wouldn't have given you education at all, you see. And that was it. It really was there for that reason. So you get minimalistic education. And even then, they turned out to what they called the penny novel because they got worried about the general public. They had meetings. The elites had meetings. The manufacturers and owners and so on had meetings in England. And Dickens, you know, he knew about these things and other ones too. But they had meetings because they worried if they'd lowered the working day for the peasants down from under 16 hours a day, that was the average what you had to do, and then you might get up to mischief. I mean, you might start thinking. That would cause mischief. You see, that in fact, thinking was mischief if the peasants started thinking. If they had time up to themselves, they had time to communicate and think about things. And so they had meeting. They actually said that they were terribly, they're worried about revolutions. If the people had time on their hands, they could organize and start communicating and pass information towards each other. Now they could get basic writing skills and reading skills. And so what they decided to do was try to divert the free time of the public as they lowered it down to, say, 12 hours a day or 14 hours a day, yeah, which was a great advance, by the way, in those days. And so they come out with penny novels. And just like today, they said, you understand how they did the same thing with TV. They split it into categories, including gender. What do women like to watch and what guys like to watch, things like that. So sports and so on for the guys. And lots of flesh if they can get it in. And of course, in book form, they really cared to the women big time with romantic novels, always lifting them out of where they lived in crowded, terrible red brick homes and these overcrowded cities with overcrowded houses and overcrowded rooms with no bathrooms in them and outside toilets and things like that. Well documented, by the way. This is not make believe. It completely goes against the way I was brought up, you see, because I knew that the rubbish you put on television, you know, about like the Anna Green Gables idea and lots of spin-offs for the British system. So you'd always have the rich young girl and or the young master, you know, who's the son of the master, the young master. With their coaches and footmen and all that kind of stuff, and everybody seemed to have some kind of work, but they didn't take into inner cities and show squalor and folk dying through overwork, malnutrition, because even if you worked, you were on such a substance. It wasn't even substance's wage; it wouldn't keep you alive, and folk didn't often hit 30 years of age. That's the reality of it. But if you just watch the BBC, you think about all these wonderful things of folk who were well-dressed coachmen, butlers and servants, and even the highway robbers, the highwaymen, are well-dressed too in these BBC, you know, old-fashioned productions of this glorious past. And all had horses and so on. You didn't have, if you're a peasant, you didn't have a horse, you know. They'd lock you up wondering where you stole it from because you couldn't have a horse. It was expensive to have horses. And to keep horses. And again, I've mentioned before, sometimes down through Europe and in Britain too, you couldn't wear silk. If you could, if you had it, even if you found it, a bit of silk. And they passed a law in time so the peasants couldn't wear silk. It was above their station, you understand. Being a peasant, you had to always know you were a peasant and just accept it. And grovel, and if you had a hat, you know, you doffed the hat, as he called it, and bowed, so you scraped and all that. And that was a system that really existed. Really did. And you get out of that temporarily if you're a guy, if you joined the military. And that that system existed right through into the mid-1900s. Actually, it's back again. The system really stopped with its continuous wars that I even talked about from the Pentagon, the articles and so on. They talked about perpetual war would be the new norm, and we're in it, of course, been in it for a long time. And it wasn't just a war on nations and resources to take over them for the elite families and big corporations, but it was a war on the public themselves. And that's really what you've been in. So, but the people who lived in each era didn't live in utter despair, you understand? That's what I'm getting. They rely upon this basic natural humanity in people. And sure enough, little charities can start, and a penny here and a penny there. And pennies one time worth a bit of money. You could buy a loaf of them at one time before an inflation set in with a con game of paper money. But they would help each other out with charities. Not great, but hopefully it would keep you alive, maybe. You know? But it wasn't the greatest system. There was no welfare system, unemployment system. And the wars were always on the go then, too, the British Empire, this private business, it was called the British Empire. And that's what it was. It was a private business for the elite families of London, the city of London. And the bankers, naturally. But it was pretty. So guys could escape for a little. If they could live through it, through the wars and all the rest of it. If they could live through that, they might get some kind of a little pension out of it, and the bit of respect that came. Isn't it ironic? You get a bit of respect by serving the system that's kept you in squalor, and maybe your parents and grandparents too, if you had them. It's quite something. And then they teach you to respect it. And that was the great invention, really, of the 20th century. They came out of World War One, the mass slaughter of all nations involved, and the wiping out of a generation, really. Sometimes three generations. Sometimes you had sometimes people had their grandparents and their parents and and youngsters, sons, wiped out, totally, yeah, from villages and counties all through England, Scotland, and Ireland and Wales. Yeah. Wiped out completely. Yeah. So much so that when World War II came out, there were lots of empty farms or farms. There was maybe one person working it, and they couldn't even feed the population at the time. So they relied upon the shipping from, especially America, the US, and Canada, to bring in goods. But anyway, they train you that somehow. Like year zero, that's how communists do it too. They always start you off with year zero when they were taken over completely. It's a good idea, you see, because it makes sure there's another bunch of ignorant schmucks that are going to grow up never knowing what happened before. Yeah? And that's how they started, really, the 20th century, after the Boer War, countless wars in the Boer War, leading right into World War One, basically. And then after World War One, and the huge negotiations at the time by the early trade unions to get some more cash just to live on, eh? Like, I mean, folk were working and starving. Look, they didn't have cars or telephones. No, that's for basic necessities, folks. Eh? And they still had no, again, if they were laid off, they were sick, that was just too bad for you. And so they negotiated, and they wanted housing, you know, to be built. They're paying all these taxes for wars and stuff. Why couldn't you take the tax money and build houses for the people? And that's how the councils really started up for their housing committees and etc. And even then, towards the end of World War One, they run out of so many men, you know. And you can't believe how many were getting slaughtered per day after day in World War One. And massacre, that was genocide. You weren't even allowed to lie down in the mud and crawl. You were supposed to run towards the enemy through mud with big heavy packs on, through machine gun fire, no cover at all. That was very sane, wasn't it? I guess the same guys ran the war as running COVID. Right? Just closed the whole economies now. But this is the reality of it. And I've often mentioned that movie, that's a satirical movie. And musical at times, using all the old World War. They churn out during wars all these happy, happy little sing songs, type songs that people can join in. To me, you all feel you're working towards something and it's jolly good, etc., etc. So the Oh, What a Lovely War is worth watching to get the idea across. And it did have the actual figures up on a big ding-dong scoreboard daily of the thousands that were dying with this battle and that battle per day, you know. These were factual ones, and they show you the dates of them. These were actually historical facts. And, but again, that's what reminds me of. There's a much bigger plan, just like Quigley talked about with tragedy and hope. And he knew it. So he was all for it, as I say, and he was all for the creation of wars and talked about the need for wars to get stages of the big global system through. And so World War One, at least they had to negotiate to the peasantry what was left of them, decimated, right? Some concessions for all the tax money that they were dishing out all the time, and the loss of life and the horrible conditions they lived in. And for a little while, they thought they were getting somewhere. They're in need. And a lot of the guys wanting to vote, too. People think it was, oh, the women were all fighting. No, the guys didn't have the vote either unless you had property. Isn't it amazing how that's missed all the time, because it doesn't fit the modern perspectives and the modern agendas, where only women suffered or other people suffered. But no, the people themselves in Britain, yeah. The guys, the white peasants. And so, but yeah, they fight to get that kind of vote. And just when they think we're getting some concessions and getting lied to and lied to, of course, they get hit with the Great Depression. And they're back to square one. And you get out the Great Depression only temporarily because of, again, a COVID event. Remember, this is how they do it. And historians all admit this, that you would never got out of the Great Depression, even temporarily, if it hadn't been for World War II. Because suddenly, the government's borrowing billions from the same shadowy characters, you know, they're just behind the scenes. Before the wars, they're broke, right? They're always broke, completely broke, before the wars break out. And suddenly they just find this money everywhere, eh? And look, I can validate what I'm saying here. The same thing happened before 9/11. They were just dead broke in America, you know. Absolutely dead. And actually said they were fine, and so did Britain. I mean, we're just finding money. We went back over accounts, and we're just finding millions here and millions there. And although the US lost, what, $3 trillion, I think, in the Defense Department, according to Rumsfeld and so on. That was never found. It's just one of these things. You get holes in your pockets, don't you? And psychopaths have lots of holes in their pockets. But yeah, they managed to find the money for these amazing wars, and they threw, just like the COVID, they threw billions in today's money, billions at different corporations that could supply armaments and all kinds of things, and dirigible balloons that might stop low-light flying bombers coming down, which you never did, because they were much higher than that. And it didn't matter. See, facts don't matter about the waste of money. And then appoint these commissars in charge of trade and all things in Britain. They disappoint them, because you're going to suspend democracy, saving, you know. Which is exactly, by the way, when you look into the Nuremberg trials, that Hermann Göring said, it's amazing for how so long they kept the public from hearing what he was talking about, you know, on trial. But he was actually asked during interrogation on camera why the Germans had stopped the democracy, you know. And he says, because it was an emergency time, and he said it wasn't working. We need an efficient way of ordering the system back into operation. Well, that's exactly what Britain did during the war too. They stopped the democracy, martial law system, curfews, rationing, and ration cards, even travel permits within certain areas and certain places. So, countless spies within society, from your own government, to make sure that loose lips didn't sink ships. And again, your Cairns of that day too, if you see someone getting extra meat from the butcher, then report them and things like that. And all kinds of terrible things were happening. Same stuff, eh? But yeah, everybody, every company, every major corporation that existed was ready to make anything at all, manufacture anything for the war effort or COVID effort or whatever. It's all the same, you see. So they pulled Britain through temporarily, and Canada too, by the way. All countries were affected by the Great Depression to different extents, mind you. But Canada, for instance, was voted by the United Nations on a list of countries that were the most likely to succeed in industry and be very wealthy, because they put so much money into a few corporate hands, all backed by the taxpayers, that now had all these big factories that were making different machinery for the war, aircraft and so on, and they could be turned to peaceful uses. So they used the same excuses going. It was an emergency situation, so you can't have democracy. And that's okay when the West said it, though, I suppose. But there you go. You can't get it. You understand, eventually you have to break your conditioning to understand anything at all. And I've said it before, waking up is like jumping out of an airplane. And yeah, without a parachute, and you have to free fall, and have some faith that somehow, it's going to be okay. Because on the way down, you only have all these different doors opening and beckoning you, and you might see glimpses of different things and glimpses of that and so on. And you might not, and you don't want to get stuck in it. It's very much like Buddhism. In Buddhism, there's a stage they get to in Buddhism. That the priests, you know, when they're off and they're meditating and they're in solitude and so on, where they talk about supernatural or preternatural occurrences happening to them, seeing things without drugs, but seeing things and knowing things, things come to them, maybe little visions, things like that, but things that shouldn't happen, in other words. Yeah. Now, the West, in modern times, right, but from the 90s onwards, with the pushing of Wiccanism and different things like that, it really meant to get away from any kind of idea of, they destroy completely any idea of the old system of Christianity, which still gave you some kind of moral value. It had to be destroyed. So you supplant it by giving youngsters really interesting stuff. And let's be honest, I mean, every youngster wants to they do sense things when you're young, before it's completely drummed all out of you. You'll sense things, you get little ideas, little insights into things. Best pals, little children, start talking at the same time on the same subject using the same words, as an example. Or you start singing the same song at the same time, at the exact same word. Eh? And you turn and you look at each other and laugh, because it's quite natural, isn't it? Things like that. And you know when someone's going to come and visit you and things. You get these little insights, which you take for granted. And as the world gets to you, because it's not meant to make you happier or to allow you to develop naturally or have any confidence in your own experiences. You've been trained always to listen to experts and authority figures and so on via TV and so on. And so that these natural instincts are drowned out of you with the cares of the world, as I say. But with the Buddhists, they're different from the West, where they were pushing youngsters at one point just to get rid of the old religion. That's the idea behind it, of giving these insights and the what-ifs and so on. Try this and try that. And and go ghost hunting and all that kind of stuff. The idea is to get folk into it, really into it. And suddenly books appeared, I'd say even the late 80s, and you would see it in libraries and in bookstores, and books that used to have all kinds of philosophies and things suddenly were getting placed by stacks and stacks of self-help books that also incorporated the so-called supernatural into them too, and positive thinking, of course, all these kind of things were pushed into it. Most, even the ones that pretended to be spiritual, really were more positive thinking. Just want it and think about it and it'll come to you and that kind of thing. So as we're pushing now on the West, you see, which we can take over your life if you go that way completely, it will take over your life. You're actually stuck in an earthly realm by doing so. Because in Buddhism, as they go through a phase where this starts to happen, we actually experience the things very frequently. They're told to ignore them, because that's the trap. I'm talking about waking up here too. It all ties in together. That's the trap. ignore these things that try to pull you in, and because folk can get captivated by an awe and wondering, wow, wow. And like any drug, you want a bigger wow the next time until you're bigger and bigger and bigger until you're addicted, like any addict to a drug, you see. So you ignore that part to go into much higher understandings and insights. Or you get trapped. Well, that's what waking up is. It's like, I should say too, it's like coming out from under the ground, very much like the Australian Aborigines, the Dreamtime people, they sometimes like to call them. And when the explorers met the Aboriginal natives, I don't know if they call them still Aboriginals or not, odd name to call people, though, Aboriginal is like not original. That's a big question in itself. However, they're natives, and the explorers try to find out, just like anthropologists do, about them, you know, what's your history, what do you, you know, and why were they covered in what appeared to be these paintings they painted themselves. And inside the rocks, too, in caves and things like that, they would do paintings, and they explained that they about a dream time period, that's different names for the same thing. I think they've made movies about it, and some of them are really entertaining, some of them. But the kind of dream time, they were in some kind of limbo for a long time, countless eons, it could be eons, you know, after some catastrophe in the world. And it's almost like they lived in stasis in the womb of the earth, that's what it symbolized, I guess. And they came out to tell the people what had happened. But the rest of the story is we never really find out if they forgot what happened or what. But it's an awful long time, so you can't blame them. But you often find that kind of history going on with the different peoples of catastrophes long ago. Catastrophes. So you understand that reality has different meanings to different peoples according to your histories. And your how you survive and your conditions of survival around you too, whether it's kind of arid and kind of dry or good soil and wet and so on and so on, all these things to be factored into the cultures of the people, which ends up being the mentality. But people's generally always, again back to the whole point of natural humanity, they're decent to each other so they can get through hard times regardless of it, through natural phenomenon and natural hardships. But I say we also get through the unnatural ones, so the ones from wars that didn't have to happen, lockdowns, Hell is getting, you haven't seen the hell yet from the lockdowns. This is the Air Summit agenda, you know. This is it. What they tried to use for climate change for and deindustrialization, making energy itself eventually scarce for the general population, step by step into scarcities. And because they said it in all their publications that the healthier you are comes from having energy and heating, etc., and food as a start. Eh? And you can't depopulate the world when folk are healthy, and they won't listen to you when they're healthy, and they want to work and earn money and spend on things, etc., and buy things, and that has to stop. Well, bingo, you know. Here you go. Again, back to Australians, I always think, too, that if people had been like natives there and natives in other areas in the world who live very simply, that you might laugh at when you think about them. Oh, my, how can they live like that? Lots of them are still living like they lived for thousands of years. And as Plato said, the easiest systems to fall apart quickly and get and cause massive death are artificial systems and the cities, of course. The old occultic ideas of the city, very important. But completely artificial, and everything that's built inside the city, all the different systems of commerce, they're all artificial too, you see. And one collapses, and the next one collapses like dominoes and dominoes and dominoes until they're all collapsed. And that's how fast the whole thing can vanish. That's what Plato's uncle, Solon, supposedly told him. And he found his writings that his uncle had kept too. That's where they got the story of Atlantis from. That's where he came from. And his uncle had gone to Egypt, like most of the aristocracy of the ancient world went. You know, the wealthy went to different parts of the world for their higher education, which is kind of occultic system of degreed system. And of course they went to Egypt for part of it, and Solon, you know, according to Plato, and the writings of his uncle, was told by the priests of Egypt. He says, you know, you Greeks, how old do you think you are? And they gave him some kind of number, and they kind of laughed at him. He says, you don't even know your history or how long you've existed as a people. Now they're talking into a time, obviously, that was before writing even occurred. For them, for the Greeks, anyway. And it said too that many civilizations had risen to great peaks of power, yeah, and totally collapsed. And getting back to say that the more artificial they are, the easier and quicker they are to collapse. So it's come and gone, many of them that we don't even have the records of. Yeah. And that's why Plato talked about the fragility of the advanced systems. Now, what I'm telling you too is known by those who rule the world, because they always plan their own survival, and they use all of you to get there. Generations of us to get there, to get to their advanced system, almost a very space age type system, where they themselves will be the superhumans, you know, if not the gods themselves. And some of the religions I have out there, actually, they talk about being gods, but and again, even from a scientific point of view, they say, what is a god? A god's got power of life and or death, could be immortal. If you meet yourself to be immortal, then you become a god, and power over others, ultimate power, total power over other people through such advanced weaponry, then you power over life and death, then, you see. This is from writings of characters who've been in these organizations down through centuries. Eh? And they use us like staging rockets. I've mentioned this talk before, back in the 90s too. Because they talk about what humans are here for. You talk all of you're not actually human, you're the animals, but they talk about why you're here, and you're there to serve them. And you've always been here to serve them. And like a staging rock, in a sense. Again, getting back to what Pike talked about revolutions, but it also applies to the systems and the generations. You can't just go out there and plant a tree, you know, or a crop, and expect to grow. You've got to prepare the ground big time. Find out what you need, what's lacking in any particular soil, especially for whatever you're going to grow. There's different things you need for different crops and things, or even for trees. That's where you get different colours and different trees, and off the wood, they suck up different minerals. Different kinds of trees suck up different kind of minerals from the ground. So you prepare the ground for what you want to grow. But first you must decide what you want to grow, you see. So prepare the ground, what you need to prepare the ground, etc. You bacteria in the ground, you've got to dig it up with the air in there and get the bacteria going. And you may have to fertilize it too, to increase the bacterial load and insect. And everything's a balance, of course. And before you even decide to put the seed in, the point of putting it in into packed ground, it's impacted, there's no air in it. You know, it's just flattened. So you got to get the air, break it up and get the air in there and get the right kind of place to grow it in the first place. So a lot of work goes into the idea, as Pike explained it, and that's what he's talking about, society and revolutions. For the elite themselves, they have their revolutions. You see, you might go along with it, but whatever you're fighting for, you're being used, because they have a different goal in mind as to the outcome and where it's supposed to go. Always. Always. It never changes. Then they write the history books. So as the next generation thinks, well, this is what happened, why it happened, and of course they're lied to. Lying often takes just simple omission of half the story. You don't say, well, I never lied, you know. You just didn't tell them the rest of the story. which can completely alter your perspective on any particular incident or incidences of the whole darn war or where it happened to be, or cultural change. So we had the staging rockets to prepare the soil, you know, the first one, and we get them up, you know, into a certain height above the earth. This is allegorically speaking, of course.